Where are we going?
Keep on lying,
what's happening?
Riding on
through. Well, well, this is Greg Carpenter, and this is the Reverse Deception Show from the Veritas Radio Network Crusade Channel. I have to tell you, I am very excited today. This is going to be an extreme show. Sometimes we talk about IT, and sometimes we talk about current events, and sometimes we take a different perspective of things, and we try to get an idea of what's happening. I'm going to take a headline from just a couple days ago, and I think it's going to have a bit of a jolt on people, and it's going to change the way you think about things, hopefully forever. The headline from Front Page Magazine says, Carter banned Iranians from coming to the U.S. during hostage crisis, in speaking about Trump's perspective on what he wants to do. And the subheadline says, Trump is just like Hitler. Or Jimmy Carter. Trump is a monster, a madman, a vile racist, or he's just like Hitler or Jimmy Carter. During the Islamic Revolution's Iranian hostage crisis, in which Islamists took over the country, Carter issued a number of orders to put pressure on Iran. Among these, Iranians were banned from entering the United States unless they opposed the Shiite Islamic regime or had a medical emergency. Here's Carter's quote from back in 1980, quote, Fourth, the Secretary of the Treasury, parentheses, state, and the Attorney General will invalidate all visas issued to Iranian citizens for future entry into the United States effective today. We will not reissue visas, nor will we issue new visas, except for compelling and proven humanitarian reasons or where the national interest of our own country requires. This directive will be interpreted very strictly. Apparently, banning people from a terrorist country is not against our values after all. It may even be who we are. Either that or Carter was a racist monster just like Trump. While Iran was a nation, it was targeted because it was overrun by Shiite Islamists who were engaging in terrorism against America. Sunni Islamists, like ISIS, have a big footprint in far more countries than Iran did, so a visa banning targeting them needs to be much broader in scope than going after one country. Does that mean that we go out and start knocking them off one at a time? Something to think about. Meanwhile, here's how the Iranian students who had been notorious for anti-American protests in the U.S. retreated. Carter ordered 50,000 Iranian students in the U.S. to report to immigration offices with view to deporting those in violation of their visas. On 27 December 1979, U.S. Appeals Court allows deportation of Iranian students found in violation. So that shouldn't be very outrageous to anybody, because if people are in violation of their visa, well, then they shouldn't be here, right? That's just common sense. So even back in 1979, we were not enforcing the law the way we were supposed to. In November 1979, the Attorney General had given all Iranian students 1 month to report to the local immigration office. Around 7,000 were found in violation of their visas. Around 15,000 Iranian students were forced to leave the U.S. The ACLU protested. Lawyers sued over the deportation and lost. First Amendment objections were set aside by a federal appeals court. Meanwhile, any Iranians entering the U.S. were forced to undergo secondary screening. Didn't know there was a First Amendment objection to violating a law in a country that you're visiting. But continuing on, Carter did this by invoking the Nationality Act of 1952, a law originally opposed by Democrats for its attempt to restrict communist immigration to the United States. Quote, if this oasis of the world should be overrun, perverted, contaminated, or destroyed, then the last flickering light of humanity will be extinguished. Close quote. Senator McCarran said of the law. He was a Democrat. Now, unlike Muslims, Iranians were not necessarily supportive of Islamic terror. Many were and are opposed of it. Khomeini didn't represent Iran as a country, but his Islamic allies. So Trump's proposal is far more legitimate than Carter's actions. Carter targeted people by nationality. Trump's proposal does so by ideology. Classifying Iranians as a group is closer to racism than classifying people by a racist supremacy ideology that calls for the mass murder and enslavement of non-Muslims, as ISIS is doing today. You know, one of the interesting facts about the Nationality Act of 1952 was it barred the entry of any aliens who were polygamists or who practiced polygamy or advocated any type of polygamy at all. Just an interesting point. But the main reason for this article is to get a perspective. Iranians hate Americans. Like, we got that. So the Sunnis hate Americans, who are the ISIS guys. The Shia, who are the Iranians, hate Americans also, who are the non-ISIS people. So why do they hate Americans so much? What really happened there? Has it ever been talked about? Is it something that gets discussed in school? Or do you just learn that Iranians always hated Americans? Well, that simply isn't the case. Iranians didn't always hate the Americans. And we have to go back a couple weeks or so to get the perspective on this. For what we're going to talk about, it starts with a guy named Ahmad Shah Qajar. And he was the Shah, or the king of Iran, from 1909 to 1925. In the aftermath of the Russian Revolution, Persia had become a battleground. And in 1917, Britain used Persia as a springboard for an attack into Russia. It was an unsuccessful attempt to reverse the Russian Revolution. The new Soviet Union responded by annexing portions of northern Persia as buffer states, much like its czarist predecessor did, creating the Persian Soviet Socialist Republic. They marched on Tehran, and the Soviets extracted even more humiliating concessions from the Qajar government, whose minister Ahmad Shah was often unable to control. The weakness of the central bureaucracy in the face of such aggression by an atheist foreign power sparked seething anger among many traditional Persians, including a young guy named Ruhollah Khomeini, who would later condemn both the communists and monarchy as treason against Persia's sovereignty and the laws of Islam. By 1920, the government had lost virtually all power outside of the capital. British and Soviet forces exercised control over most of Iranian mainland. And in late 1920s, the Soviets in Rasht prepared to march on Tehran with a guerrilla force of about 1,500. There were Janglis, Kurds, Armenians, Azerbaijanis, and they were reinforced by the Soviet Red Army. This, along with various other unrest in the country, created an acute political crisis in the capital. On 14 January 1921, British General Ironside chose to promote Reza Khan, who had been leading the Tabriz battalion, to promote him to lead the entire brigade. About a month later, under the British direction, Reza Khan led his 3,000 to 4,000 strong detachment of the Cossack Brigade to Tehran and seized the capital. He forced the dissolution of the previous government and demanded that Sayyid Zayeddin Tabatabai be appointed prime minister. Reza Khan's first new role in the government was as the commander of the Iranian army, which he combined with the post of minister of war. He took the title of commander-in-chief in the army, by which he was known until he later became the Shah. While Reza Khan and his Cossack brigade secured Tehran, the Persian envoy in Moscow negotiated a treaty with the Bolsheviks for the removal of Soviet troops from Persia. Article 4 of the Russo-Persian Treaty of Friendship allowed the Soviets to invade and occupy Persia, should they believe foreign troops were using it as a staging area for an invasion of Soviet territory. As Soviets interpreted the treaty, they can invade should events in Persia prove threatening to Soviet national security. Now, this treaty is going to cause a lot of tension and problem between the two nations until for years to come. The coup d'etat of 1921 was partially assisted by the British government, which wished to halt the Bolsheviks' penetration of Iran, particularly because of the threat it posed to the British possessions in India. It is thought that the British provided ammunition, supplies, and pay for Reza's troops. On 8 June 1932, the British Embassy report states that the British were interested in helping Reza Shah create a centralizing power. The commander of the British forces in Iran, General Ironsides, gave a situation report to the British War Office saying that a capable Persian officer was in command of the Cossacks, and that would resolve many of the difficulties and enable them to depart in peace and honor. Sound familiar? Something like that happened before. Talk about honor when you're ending a conflict and you're looking to end it and get out. Peace with honor? Yeah. Reza Khan spent the rest of 1921 securing Iran's interior, responding to a number of revolts that erupted against the new government. Among the greatest threats to the new administration were the Persian Soviet Socialist Republic, which had been established in Golan, and the Kurds of Khorasan. By 1923, Reza Khan had largely succeeded in securing Iran's interior from any remaining domestic and foreign threats. So, the Kurds are a problem. Is this sounding familiar to anybody? There's a dispute because Britain is meddling in the internal affairs. A British-backed coup d'etat took the rightful king out of place and put in one who was more friendly to them. So the previous Shah, Ahmad Shah, left Iran, went to Europe, and he stayed there voluntarily for a while during this coup d'etat. And eventually he died there in 1930. It induced the parliament to grant Reza Khan dictatorial powers, too, in Iran, who in turn he assumed the symbolic and horrific styles of Janab I Ashrat, or His Serene Highness. By October 1925, he succeeded in pressuring the Majils to dispose and formally exile Ahmad Shah. It was done according to the law, per se. Now, if you're just joining us, this is Greg Carpenter, Reverse Deception Radio. We're talking about the history of the Middle East, and are things really the way they're presented to you today? Talked a little bit about British meddling in Iranian politics and how the British helped to depose a previous Shah and put in a Shah of their own liking, Reza Khan. During Reza Khan's 16 years of rule, major developments happened. Road construction projects, Trans-Iranian Railway, modern education. The government sponsored European education for many Iranian students. The number of modern industrial plants increased 17-fold. And the number of miles of highway increased from 2,000 to 14,000. Additionally, several modernization efforts were put in place in public health, sanitation, water, things like that. Reza Shah was the first Iranian monarch in 1,400 years who paid respect to the Jews by praying in the synagogue when visiting the Jewish community, an act that boosted the self-esteem of Iranian Jews and made Reza Shah their second most respected Iranian leader after Cyrus the Great. Cyrus the Great was the guy who established Persia 2,500 and something years before. So there's a whole bunch of people in between. Reza Shah's reforms opened new occupations for Jews and allowed them to leave the ghettos. And his reign became more secure, Reza Shah clashed with Iran's clergy and devout Muslims on many issues. In March 1928, he violated the sanctuary of Qoms, the Fatima al-Moshmeh shrine, to beat a cleric who had angrily admonished Reza Shah's wife for temporarily exposing her face a day earlier while on pilgrimage to Qom. In December of that year, he instituted a law requiring everyone, except some of the Shias, who had passed a special qualifying examination, to wear Western clothes. This angered devout Muslims because it included a hat with a brim, which prevented the devout from touching their foreheads on the ground during Salat, as required by Islamic law. The Shah had also encouraged women to discard hijab. He announced that female teachers could no longer come to school with head coverings. The devout were also angered by policies that allowed mixing of the sexes. Women were allowed to study in the College of Law and Medicine, and in 1934, a law set heavy fines for cinemas, restaurants, and hotels that did not open their doors to both sexes. Doctors were permitted to dissect human bodies. He restricted public mourning observances on one day and required mosques to use chairs instead of traditional sitting on the floor of mosques. By the mid-1930s, Reza Shah's rule had caused intense dissatisfaction to the Shia clergy throughout Iran. In 1935, a backlash erupted in the Mashhad Shrine, responding to a cleric who denounced the Shah's heretical innovations, corruption, and heavy consumer taxes. Many bazaarists and villagers took refuge in the shrine, chanting slogans such as, "The Shah is a new Yazid." For four full days, local police and army refused to violate the shrine. The standoff was ended when troops from the Iranian Azerbaijan arrived and broke into the shrine, killing dozens and injuring hundreds, and marking the final rupture between Shiite clergy and the Shah. Some of the Mashhad clergy even left their jobs. The Shah intensified his controversial changes following the incident, banning the Shahdor and ordering all citizens, rich and poor, to bring their wives to public functions without head coverings. The origin of the Persian custom of the Shahdor is in ancient Mesopotamia, where respectable women veiled and servants and prostitutes were forbidden to do so. The veil marked class status, and this dress code was regulated by sumptuary law. So this is something that has a deep historical meaning, a deep historical purpose. It means a lot. Respectable people do this up first. There's other reasons for them to do it too, and we'll get to that in a second. Achaemenid Iranian women in art were mostly veiled, and the first representations of Shador is found on Ergili scripture and the Satrap sarcophagus from Persian Anatolia. The earliest written record of Shador can be found in Pahlavi scripts from the 6th century as a female headdress worn by a Zoroastrian woman. It is likely the custom of veiling continued through the Seleucid, Parthian, and Sassanid periods. Veiling was not limited to women, but was practiced also by Persian shahs. Upper-class Greeks and Byzantine women were also secluded from the public gaze. The 20th century Pahlavi ruler, Reza Shah, banned the Shador and all hijab. In 1936, the police were arresting women who wore the veil and forcibly removing it. This policy outraged the Shia clerics and ordinary men and women to whom appearing in public without their cover was tantamount to nakedness. Many women refused to leave the house in fear of being assaulted by Reza Shah's police. However, this move was welcomed by Westernism and upper-class men and women who saw it in liberal terms as a first step in granting women their rights. However, for regular non-activist women, it amounted to torture and desecration of their religion and themselves. A few even committed suicide. Do we really understand what we're asking other cultures to do or we're forcing other cultures to do? We don't, do we? We don't know the deep emotional ties and religious implications things like this have. We just think it doesn't fit with our culture, so it's not nice and we don't like it. Before the 1978-79 Islamic Revolution, black chadors were reserved for funerals and periods of mourning. Light, printed fabric were normally worn every day. Currently, the majority of women wear the chador in a reserved kind of a light-colored way around the house for prayers, things like that. The black one is still only used in certain situations. You're seeing a lot more of it now for other reasons. but it has nothing to do with the traditional wear of the chador itself.
So think about it this way. We started off talking about how Donald Trump and Jimmy Carter are pretty much doing the same thing in a similar type of a way, in a similar way that Hitler did it, in the similar way that FDR did it, in a similar way that Woodrow Wilson did it, and numerous other world leaders calling for the deportation of certain groups of people for certain reasons. But do we really understand why we're asking certain people to leave and why certain people get to stay? A point to think on when we come back. Greg Carpenter, Reverse Deception Radio, here on the Veritas Radio Network Crusade Channel. Continuing in segment two, we're going to get deeper into this, and we're going to give you the answers to questions you never thought you even had.
Against the West Coast, Warner Brothers are such good hosts. I raise my whiskey glass and give them a toast. I'm sure they know it's true. I got no rap against the Southern states. Every time I've been there, it's been great. But now I'm leaving and I can't be late. And to myself be true. The Midwest, the folks out there have given me their best. I've lived there all my life, I've been their guest. I sure have loved it too. I'm tired of looking at the TV news. I'm tired of driving hard and paying dues. I figure, baby, I got nothing to lose. I'm tired of being blue.
Reverse Deception. We'll be right back on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.